Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to be talking about ingredients from a number of different perspectives, starting with one that's been very popular and inspirational of late, which is the relationship between chefs and their various farmers, growers, producers. And the book is gorgeous to behold. It's called Harvest to Heat. And we're going to be talking to Daryl Estrine, who is the author. It's the first book he's ever written, although he's long been involved with the food world, and he is an accomplished photographer. And the photography in this particular book is not only his, but a wonderful woman's work, and it's just gorgeous. So anyhow,
here's Harvest to Heat.
Harvest to Heat. It's a good title, Daryl Estrine. Did you think of that?
We did. Kelly and I both thought of that. We both come from the advertising business, so we know how to be catchy.
And it's subtitled Cooking with America's Best Chefs, Farmers, and Artisans. And it is jam-packed with really wonderful photos, text, recipes, stories, characters. I think you have a winner.
Oh, well, thank you.
You sort of made an unusual transition to becoming a writer.
Yes, I've been a magazine and advertising photographer for 25 years, photographed celebrities, athletes, Fortune 500 executives, all kinds of people, worked on campaigns for big brands, and really loved food. And I moved up to the Hudson Valley about 8 years ago. I was looking for a project to do for myself, a photo project. So I went out, and I had read about these guys who made bourbon, and I'd read maybe 6 months even before I photographed them. And I tracked them down and said, can I come out and photograph you? And they said, no problem, come on over. I had a great time. It got me on the trail immediately. I called it a cheesemaker in the Hudson Valley. I called a smokehouse up near Poughkeepsie. I started meeting all these people, and then Kelly and I met.
Yeah, Kelly Kochendorfer.
Kelly Kochendorfer, who was an editor at the launch of Savour. And Kelly and I met and got talking and sort of thought, well, there's something here. And I didn't want to do just a coffee table book of photographs. I wanted to do a book that people would really use. So that's kind of the genesis of it.
And the writing part was what I meant, because previously you had just written with images.
Yeah, absolutely. What we did is we were introduced to an agent across the street from my office on Bleecker by a friend, and she said, well, I love your idea. This is what a book proposal looks like, and she shoved a 40-page proposal in my hand and said, go write one. And so Kelly and I went and wrote it, and then realized, you know, we could do this. And so.
Well, you've gotten stunning comments about it. The foreword is by Alice Waters. That's not shabby at all.
Yeah, we're very, very fortunate and very happy to get that.
Right, and then I never know what you call these testimonials.
The blurbs.
The blurbs.
Okay. Yeah, the blurb story is funny. When the book is about two-thirds of the way done, the publisher sends out for blurbs.
Mm-hmm.
And with Alice Waters, we sent it to her, and she said, well, I'll write the blurb, but if you want me to write the foreword, I'd be happy to. That was easy. And then the other funny one was we had sent it to Tom Colicchio, and it came back as, well, I'll write the blurb, but how come I'm not in the book? And little did Mr. Colicchio know, someone in his office had said no to us earlier on, and now he wanted it in the book, so we, of course, was happy to get him in the book.
Oh, yeah, he's in the book.
Yeah, he's in it. So you can't have the book blurbed if you're in the book, so we were happy to get him in there.
Oh, so Batali is not in the book.
No, but his pastry chef, Gina De Palma, who's a fantastic woman.
Oh, I love Gina.
Is in the book.
Well, now let's explain the structure of the book, just so that people get an idea of whether it's something that they're going to want to add to their collection.
Because we think
it's great, but we have a very large collection.
Right. Well, I can break it down for you. Basically, there's four elements to the book. There's 100 recipes from the best chefs across the country. We asked them, who do you want to cook with? And they would say, this artisan, this farmer, we'd let them go. And then there's food photography, absolutely beautiful food photography.
Now, did you do that?
No, Ellen Silverman did that, and just, it's gorgeous. People rub that cover of that book like a genie's bottle that's going to come to life. It's hilarious. I've seen so many people do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just a riot. And then there's portraits, which I did. I photographed the artisans and the chefs together, sometimes in the kitchen, sometimes at the farm, sometimes on the water.
That's funny, because I thought the lighting was so totally different for those shots. You notice the difference in style between the products and the...
Very, very different. And then there's the artisan profiles, and we wanted to highlight great American product and these producers via the celebrity of these chefs. That, those are the four elements. So the photos, portrait, the stories about everyone, and the recipes.
So the heroes of the book are really the producers?
The farmers and the artisans, absolutely.
Rather than the chefs. I mean, everything seems to revolve around chefs. It's so nice to have a point of view that says, what many great chefs will tell us, that the secret is in the produce, and what you have to do is make sure you don't mess it up.
Exactly.
I thought this was cute, this four shy brothers and a savior. What kind of a thing is that? Two sets of fraternal brothers, all farmers. I mean, three of them farmers, I guess.
I bet their parents gave up after that.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
The only reason they wouldn't have finished up with a baseball team is because that requires an odd number.
Right. You know, the interesting thing about so many of these artisans and farmers is that they've had to sort of reconfigure what they were doing, or they literally, like Keith Martin, going from being a stock guy, you know, stockbroker, to being a farmer of some of the best lamb in the country. I would say a large group of the people, the artisans in this book, come from some other field before they ended up in food.
Right, and then they retired to the country, or they just decided they were fed up with the world, they understood and decided they would do something even harder.
Yeah, even harder. I think that's the key point.
Yeah, I mean,
it's okay that it's harder.
We have people who are, what's that one from Flower Bakery that, she was, what, a nuclear physicist or something?
She was some kind of super-duper mathematician.
Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, and she opened a bakery. Then we have the lady who was a trader on Wall Street. She ditched that and has a company now called Fat Witch Brownies.
Right, doing very well.
Yes.
Yeah. So Mark Furstenberg, the baker down in D.C., who's had a number of restaurants and other things, said, I just wanted to make something. And that's really what it got down to for a lot of people. They really wanted to make something authentic and real and tangible.
Can you just sort of run through, just mentioning, name drop for me, name drop some of these chefs to give people an idea of what level we're dealing with?
Sure. We have, in the front, there's this beautiful fold-out that has every chef and artisan.
You know, that's the one thing I didn't understand. I had a terrible time trying to work with that.
It gets crunched a little bit, but, you know, it's kind of a nice little extra note. So there's everybody from Eric Repaire. And we have every four-star chef from New York City is in the book. Daniel Ballou, John George, Eric, Thomas Keller. Daniel Hum is in the book. My daughter's favorite recipe she now just refers to as world's greatest chicken, which is stuffed with truffle butter. It ain't bad.
Well, we have truffle butter. We do have truffle butter. But we don't have a four-story farm chicken, unfortunately.
Yeah, maybe
I'll serve some truffle butter with the Whole Foods turkey breast.
Yeah.
Not
as sexy, but still probably not so bad. And then Kelly did an amazing job of picking the chefs, because we really wanted, we wanted these superstars. They really deserved it because they supported so many of these artisans and farmers. And then we wanted to dig down deeper, people who were just starting to be acknowledged. People like Sean Brock is now just taken off since we first
good
started.
Friend of ours. We just did a long interview with him.
Yeah, I mean, he just got
He's
that
on
huge,
our website now.
He got that huge piece in the New York Times a couple weeks ago.
I missed that. What was that about?
Really taken off, because I think he's got a new restaurant going. So.
Oh, Husky, right.
You know, he's in Esquire now on a regular basis. And so she did a great job of picking sort of different people. And we got suggestions. One of my friends works in the movie business. She does hair for movie stars. And she travels all the time and eats like crazy. And she recommended a couple people in out-of-the-way places, like Derek Wagner, this great chef in Providence.
Yeah, now him I don't know, but most of these people are really like friends of ours. So they're just, it's wonderful for me to look through the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've got, you know,
some people. Barbara Lynch, I love Barbara Lynch.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah. She's just fantastic. And from Chicago, we loved Paul Kahan. We went out and spent the day at Dave Cleaverden's farm with Paul. And Dave grows some of the best arugula in the Midwest, and people just crave it. And it was pretty great. And going to places, you know, meeting Rick Bayless, people like that. It's just been, and then the young guys, even in the Midwest, like Paul Varant, who's just a little outside of Chicago. We worked with him and Will Allen. You know, Will Allen is the MacArthur Genius Award winner.
Is he really?
Yeah, he's a former NBA basketball player who decided to join the food revolution, as he calls it. And you go to his place where he grows in the middle of Milwaukee in these burned out sort of areas.
It looks
like Sanford and Son. But he's just amazing. what he's doing on small plots of land.
And I didn't realize that Donald Link's brother supplies him with fish.
Yes, yeah. That was one of my favorite phone calls. I did a lot of the interviews by phone, and I'd have him on speaker, and sometimes I got my daughter or my wife to listen because the accent, his New Orleans accent is so, Louisiana is so deep, it's just fantastic.
It is. He told us a funny story. Somebody in New Orleans told us a funny story. I forget who it was. It might have been him. That growing up, if you bought fish from a fish shop, you were doing the wrong thing. You know, if you were really serious about your fish, you got to buy from the people when they landed the fish before they went to the fish market to
right.
sell it. You would get a quiet home delivery on the side.
Right.
So yours would be cheaper. It would also be fresher.
Right. If you were one step removed, you knew you didn't have any power.
Well, and then, of course, now you have all the top chefs, and then the producers are celebrities onto their themselves also. Like Farmer Jones. Isn't he a character, huh?
Lee Jones, he's... You know, when you meet him at first, you kind of think he's a cartoon character. You know, the tie, the hat, the whole thing. And it's just his being, he's such a sweetheart. Mm-hmm. But when you get talking, you realize that this guy is the real deal, that he knows what he's talking about. The depth and breadth of what he offers chefs and how he ships it and how he does it, it's just, it's mind-blowing.
Did you know that he was at an event with Alain Ducasse? And he got Alain Ducasse to wear one of his horrible, silly clip-on red bow ties.
Oh, really? It works for him. It's a good branding element.
Well, you have a lot of information here. You sound like you had a great time putting this all together. And it's not going to stop there. I mean, people should absolutely get the book.
The book
Harvest
is...
Harvest of Heat.
Yeah.
And you... When we were chatting, you mentioned that this was a springboard for a whole bunch of other projects.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about those?
Well, right now we're working on doing the fundraising to do a television show based on the book for PBS. We want to do a really great U.S. travel, cooking, classic kind of great show, a little more modern, a little fast-paced, that brings all these people to life. So that's one thing we're doing. We've got Le Creuset as one of our sponsors so far. And we're teaming up with our publisher to get more sponsors, so we're working on that. Our plan is to get it on the air in January of 2012,
uh-huh.
So we'll be shooting all summer. And then we're working on our proposal for book two right now, and I think we're working on website, kind of making our website more robust, doing all that kind of stuff. So we've got a lot of stuff going on.
Now, what is the website, Daryl?
It's harvesttoheat.com.
Great. So that's easy, listeners. So you can keep track of all the wonderful adventures that Daryl's going to have in the future, as well as the wonderful adventures he's already had.
Exactly.
And you're going to want to have this lovely book. How easy the recipes are to cook. I don't know. Are they designed for the home chef?
Kelly was adamant in designing these for the home chef.
Oh, great.
And,
okay.
and that was our plan. I mean, when I tell the people who don't cook, I got an email the other day from somebody who said, I just love reading it. I haven't cooked from it yet, but I love reading the book, which is just the highest compliment, which is really nice. And then the other thing I tell people who don't cook is just try the first recipe. The first recipe is basically a piece of toast covered in olive oil and toasted with beautiful blue cheese from wherever you can. If you can get it from Jasper Hill, great. With a piece of bacon and some honey. All right? So bread, cheese, bacon, honey.
How hard can it be to figure
out? How hard can it be and how insanely good can it be? It's got so many hits and it keeps hitting you in different ways with those flavors. It's just fantastic.
Well, this book is so well thought through. I mean, I don't even know where you found your props, these beat-up utensils, for example.
Great stylist in New York.
Yeah, the styling of the photos is making me hungry. I want this roasted beets with mint.
Yeah, that's... Actually, it's funny you mentioned, I just ate at Bill's restaurant two nights ago. He's got a...
Is it Bill Talapan?
Bill Talib. He's in Westport, Connecticut.
Okay.
I don't know him. Is he...
Okay.
He went from a place, he went from a bigger place in Stamford, Connecticut, and then moved out, opened his own little restaurant in Westport called La Farm, and it's just great. I was there the other night and had a fantastic dinner, and Bill's gotten a lot of press. He's done well. He's been on Martha Stewart. He was on right before Thanksgiving and was pushing our book, which was very nice of him.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's been really fun to watch people, you know, people move around, so... some of them have moved restaurants, but Bill's recipes are great, and he's going to be working with us on a bunch of other things. We have a big event coming up in Connecticut at the Philip Johnson Glass House that we're going to have about six of our chefs. Yeah, basically the basis of the event is Harvest the Heat, and it's a fundraiser for the Glass House. It's now part of the National Historic Trust.
How are you organizing this event?
There's a Friday night dinner that's $10,000 a plate that Michelle Richard and Brian Lewis are going to be cooking at, and that'll be in the Glass House. You'll actually be able to eat dinner in the Glass House.
Why don't you send us the information about it? We'll put it up on the news,
news
page. It's on the menu at onthemenuradio.com.
Yep, we'll take care of that. Saturday there's a picnic for 250 guests. That's going to be about 5-6 chefs, 5-6 artisans, just a summer picnic. You get to roam around the grounds of the Glass House, which normally you don't get to do. It's normally a very kind of restricted tour. So it's going to be an amazing event. If somebody told me 20 years ago when I was in art school, I'd write a cookbook and it would be the basis of Philip Johnson event, I would have thought you were out of your mind.
Now, who knows what you're going to get up to next, Carol? I'm sure it'll be exciting and people are going to want to follow you, and we certainly will. But do proactively keep us informed of anything that's going on that you think we ought to know about.
Great, I will. Thank you so much
for joining us.
Nice meeting you, Daryl.
Okay, you too. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Bye.
Stay with us while we take a short break. We'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're going to be talking to an old friend of ours, Robert Schuller. Not the notorious televangelist, but he is rather a passionate prophet of produce. Formalysis, which is certainly a long-established, I'd call it the benchmark in retail produce in this country. So let's listen to Robert. I could still remember the first time I saw a package of Jerusalem artichokes, called sunchokes at the time, in the supermarket. And it was by a company that I eventually got to know very well called Melissa's. We now have Robert Schuller talking to us about Melissa's. Robert, welcome to On the Menu. Tell us, when did Melissa start?
Thank you, Ann. We started in about 1984, so it's been well over 20, 25 years now. We are actually the largest variety supplier of produce in America. We have a product line of over 1,000 different fruits and vegetables. We offer them both conventionally and exotic, but we're known for as a company who introduces new cultures of fruits and vegetables into the United States.
Was I right about the sunchokes? Weren't you the first to bring those to the supermarket?
Yes, we were one of the first to bring them to the marketplace. The original name, Jerusalem artichoke, the name didn't really exemplify what that vegetable root it was, because one, it didn't come from Jerusalem, and two, it's not related to the artichoke. Though it may have artichoke undertones in the flavor, it's actually the root of a sunflower.
Right, which is girasole in Italian.
Exactly.
Right. Well, now, what was the mission? What prompted the formation of this company?
Well, Joe and Sharon Hernandez, who had always been a family organization who always was involved in the produce arena, Joe Hernandez's father and grandfather, were always key components into bringing and having availability of different varieties of fruits and vegetables. And so when Joe Hernandez and Sharon Hernandez, a native of El Paso, Texas, decided to come into the Southern California area and realized when going into the stores that it was hard to find the produce items that they were used to growing up with, items like fresh chilies, jicama, even cilantro 25 years ago was hard to find. And in many cases, these were fruits and vegetables that you would only find at a, you know, Latino market or Hispanic market. You wouldn't find them in your regular mainstream stores. And so something clicked there, and Joan Sharon Hernandez started World Variety Produce. It wasn't until just a few years later that literally the brand name was born. Joe and Sharon Hernandez gave birth to their first and only sibling and daughter, Melissa, and hence Melissa's brand name stuck with the company. So most of often than not, consumers know us by Melissa's Produce, where in the word Melissa's, the I in Melissa's is actually a carrot.
Right.
Now, you joined the family in a slightly different way.
Yes, I've actually been with World Variety Produce, Melissa's brand, for over 15 years. I came in with a hunger for learning about everything about the produce industry, and I haven't looked back. I am actually the produce expert, the spokesperson for the company, and I keep America informed on the world of produce in America today. And I'm excited to continue that by bringing up new varieties of produce that have been available in the United States, and I like to share those stories.
Well, now, you sent us, of course, this is all seasonal, so everything changes, and some of the seasons are really short, because you were going to be sending us miniature kiwis, and they have how big a window of opportunity?
Yes, baby kiwis become available in late February to early March. Unfortunately, they're only available 3 to 4 weeks during this winter time, where it's late summers in New Zealand, and so we're able to get these exciting fruits that you typically wouldn't see. For example, the domestic season for the baby kiwi is not until late August, early September, and early October, where the baby kiwis are available for almost 6 weeks out of the year. So unfortunately, we just missed that window of opportunity, and these fruits are just exciting. In fact, you just pop them in your mouth just like a raspberry or a blackberry, because that's about the size of them. They're about the size of a nickel. They're green on the outside. They have a thin skin. No, they do not have that brown fuzzy skin characteristic. Yeah, and so you just pop them in your mouth and enjoy. They taste just as similar and just as sweet as regular kiwis. It's a different way to use them, and obviously you don't have to cut them open.
Now let's be careful. Let's not get all the vegetarians and vegans mad at us, because these are baby kiwi fruits. not young ones of the species kiwi which runs around on two legs and can't fly. Now the cherimoya was the thing that you sent in a package that I loved the most, and it is the most bizarre looking fruit you've ever seen.
Is there a pattern to those seeds? Because I couldn't figure it out, so I had to individually attack
them. I'm thinking
them.
About them from the outside. They're peculiar. They look almost like they're armor plated.
Yeah, they look like that thing that I bought once, and they told me I should keep it in water till the things opened up, the scales.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened was it rotted, and it smelled the whole house up. I don't remember what that was called. It looked like an alligator.
Well, we said
that fruit you're referring to, Ann, I believe it's called the Monstera.
That's it.
It's actually, I think what they were trying to tell you is that because the Monstera is actually a flower, if it stays on the plant, it will turn into a beautiful purple flower, kind of like an artichoke, but it doesn't look like an artichoke. It looks like a big, large lizard tail. And it's actually a fruit, if you pick it early and it doesn't bloom into a flower, it actually becomes an edible fruit from the interior. What you need to do there, and just to give you a little background about the Monstera, they're grown predominantly in the Florida area, and it's an exotic fruit, but it's also an exotic flower. And what happens is that the fruit, as it ripens up, the scales on the outside of that fruit pop off. That's an indicator of when it ripened. But it sounds like the fruit never ripened and it went bad.
Well, they had me put it in water, which is, I guess, is what you're supposed to do.
Didn't you buy it at Whole Foods?
Yeah, it was Whole Foods.
I would never have put it in water.
No, that's what
because
they told me
to it do. Wouldn't, it would, it would probably go into a coma because it's never been in water and doesn't know what to do in water.
It's your
so,
smell.
I'm sorry someone explained that to you incorrectly, but I'm here to set the record straight.
Well, we're awfully glad you are.
But the cherimoya said that the skin and the seeds were toxic. And I couldn't figure out was there a pattern in the seeds that I could, in a watermelon, you know there's a section where the seeds are on them.
Let me tell you a little about the cherimoya. The cherimoya is an exotic fruit, and it's one of those fruits that once you try, you go, oh my gosh, how did I not know about this fruit? Yes, Peter, you're correct. When you first glance at this green, scaly, large fruit, you think, you can't eat that. It looks kind of like a green grenade. It's very unusual in shape, and it ripens up. When it ripens up on the skin turns from a kind of an olive green, dark green, to almost a brown, and the scales start to turn black. When it's soft and very fragrant, then you know it's ripe. So when you cut it open, inside is a pure white interior. And inside as well are the large black seeds. Now, the black seeds are toxic, but I would find it hard to believe that someone would actually eat such large seeds. I had mentioned earlier that every once in a while, we get a call or an email about someone enjoying cherimoyas for their first time. In many cases, they've never had a cherimoya, and they might have eaten a seed or two, and they complained of a stomach ache. And that's where we communicate to them, well, you're not supposed to eat the seeds, because they are toxic. And of course, from one cherimoya alone, there are probably about a dozen or two seeds in there. It's not enough to actually create something dangerous or fatal. But if you were able to eat a large amount of them, I think you can be very, very sick. So I don't recommend that. But I don't think the flavor of them, they're hard, they're black. I don't think most people would eat a big black seed. It would be like trying to eat a pit of a plum. Don't do it.
But flesh is really delicious.
The flesh is white and creamy. It's almost like creme brulee. The flavors are outrageous. They have pineapple and papaya and mango going on there. And this is all in a white custardy-like flesh.
It reminds me a little bit of a lychee nut.
Except it's softer
just
in texture.
Just a little bit. There's a little bit of that very unusual sweet flavor that you get in lychee nuts.
Yeah. Actually, it's one of my five favorite tropical fruits.
And what are your others? What are the others?
My other favorite tropical fruits include, I love mangosteen, and mangosteen was that fruit we introduced to the United States 3 years ago. It's been a fruit that has grown in Southeast Asia, Central and South America.
Yeah, and the last time we met you, I think you were still in the process of working with USDA to get approval to bring it in. You had some that had been, I think, prepared in advance and shipped as ripe fruit.
Yes.
But you were trying to get the whole mangosteens in the last time we talked.
Right. The mango, they've always had been growing mangosteens in Hawaii. However, Hawaii does not have enough supply to actually produce a commercial crop for the rest of the United States. So we had to look elsewhere, and we looked to Thailand to be able to bring in these fruits. So during the months of late April, we're coming up to the season, late April, all the way through about August, we're able to get in mangosteens from Thailand now. And they are just a luscious fruit. The title mangosteen makes you think or implies that it's related to the mango. It is not. It is totally different. The only similarities is it's grown in a subtropical climate. It is a purple fruit, kind of like the shape of a persimmon. Purple on the outside with a thick skin, and on the inside, it has a white and almost translucent flesh, something between the cherimoya flesh and a lychee flesh that you had just mentioned.
Okay, all right. Well, this is an absolutely fascinating business. I mean,
you sent us also two things that, I mean, for people who are, I'm just amazed at the rationale behind seedless lemons. I mean, how much easier anybody's cooking job would be with seedless lemons. And also those wonderful pickled tangerines, which have no seeds either and are sweet as anything. Tell me, what percentage of stuff still out there that we don't know anything about?
Oh, well, I think for a company that has over 1,000 different items, I think we continue to just scratch the surface of the many varieties that are available to us, whether it's yellow pomegranate, which are very predominant in Europe. Of course, here in the United States, all we know of are red pomegranates, right? And other fruits, medlars, jumbo.
Yeah, medlars. Why are they not allowed in? Because we love those. We get them in Italy. In fact, I was surprised. I thought they were all bad because they had brown spots on them until I saw them reproduced as a marzipan. And it had brown spots on it, too, so they're supposed to be like that.
Yeah, well, that kind of explains it. It is a fruit that is known in Europe and in Asia, but not known in the United States. So, one, there hasn't been a big demand for them. There's only a few foodies out there, like yourselves, Ann and Peter, that know about them. Two, they don't grow domestically here in the United States, nor, as far as I'm familiar, do they grow in Hawaii, but I could be wrong. And so there's no commercial crop. And three, in working with USDA and FDA to be able to allow to bring these fruits in legally into the United States, you just can't bring them in or smuggle them in because, you know, if you if you do that, there's a possible problem with maybe some type of bug getting released into the United States and ruining the crops. So it's always a very timely, you know, once we see that there's demand for it and you know, that consumers are asking for it, from there we, as a company, Melissa's World Variety Produce, moves forward to take the steps to allow that to happen, and that's why we're so familiar with bringing in all these new exciting varieties.
Tell me this, can people order off your website, or do you
have
one? And what is the website?
Melissas.com.
No apostrophe, just
MelissasAs.com. Or they can just call our consumer hotline, a mail order department, which is 800-588-0151. And if it's in season, we'll find a way to get it to you here in the United States.
Yeah, the season. I'm still waiting for Australian finger limes. They must be worth their weight in gold.
Actually, you don't have to wait anymore, Ann and Peter. We've just ended the season back in January. Last year, 2010, we introduced the finger limes to the United States for the first time. The crop is supposed to be October through December. They're now grown in California.
Really?
However, the season went really late, and the season actually started in December, and we had them all the way through the end of January. They are an exciting fruit. They're also known as citrus caviar because what these fruits are they're small. They look like a little banana. They're smaller than the size of your pinky. When you split open the skin, which is a greenish, almost blackish color, inside are these light yellow to light green little balls of citrus, little citrus pockets, bursting of citrus. And so when you cut open one, even though it's very small, smaller than the pinky finger, there's a thousand of these little balls, citrus bursts inside. The chefs love working with them.
Yeah, but honestly, Robert, I mean, there's so much. I think we should really direct people to your website because they have to know all the stuff you carry to understand what they're missing if they don't try these new species of everything. It be them just a better variety of known product or new and exotic. It's all there. I'm just amazed.
Well, thank you. And there was two items that you didn't mention, you mentioned earlier, but we didn't get to talk to them. And I think they are so spectacular. And you and Peter got to both try them. It was the seedless lemons. And see, the seedless lemons, up until recently.
Yeah, we just talked about those.
They were just not available in the marketplace. And it was the food service trend that brought them to be available at the consumer level. So now you can go off into the stores and find seedless lemons. You don't have to deal with seeds anymore. And then the other fruit you had mentioned briefly are those Ojai Pixie Tangerines, and that is a season you don't want to miss. The season just started in March and will be available only through the end of May, early June. These are the most spectacular clementines, mandarin tangerines. They're seedless. They peel easily. They brix high in a refractometer.
Really?
Those are a favorite of mine for fruit here in the United States.
Me too. I love them too.
Do you have an exotic fruit
of the month club?
There's actually, yes, if you do go on to our website, Melissa.com.
Sign me up for that.
we do have an exotic fruit month club, and one of the ones, because we're getting into the peak of the season for cherimoyas, which we just spoke about a little bit, that is actually the fruit of the month coming up. So definitely a fruit you need to try, and sign up for that because you're going to be tasting some of these other fruits that we were just talking about a little while ago.
Oh, you're wonderful, Robert. As usual, you know so much. And I thank you. And as I said, sign me up for the exotic fruit of the month.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ann and Peter.
And we'll be back after another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Who do we have now, sweetheart?
Yeah, well, we're going to shift our focus from retail to the very specialized, exciting field of supplying the top chefs in this country with special products. And it's Tyler Gray, and the company is Makuni Wild Harvest. And you'll find they make a lot more than do a lot more than foraging and supplying mushrooms.
And you're in for a wild ride because Tyler Gray talks a mile a minute.
Right.
And he was talking to us on his cell phone from Bryant Park in New York between meetings. So be ready for your heart to race while you hear the fascinating story.
Well, listeners, you're going to have a really interesting story from our next guest, Tyler Gray of Mikuni Wild Harvest. I've been trying to understand exactly what Tyler does, and he does a lot. Welcome on the menu, Tyler. I'm going to ask you to give our, just so we know where we're coming from and where we're going, if you can give us like a brief synopsis of what Mikuni Wild Harvest is as a company.
Absolutely, and thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So Mikuni is a company that was started 9.5 years ago by me and my two partners. I've got some wonderful partners, and we started with the vision of trying to introduce kind of the top chefs of North America to the most refined and boutique and specific wild foraged foods. So wild mushrooms, wild truffles, wild berries, wild vegetables, flowers, herbs, lettuces, you name it. We were very, very passionate and specific about working with the top restaurants and supplying them with really hard to get and quality suspect wild foods. Wild food, you can't really control how they grow or what they look like, so it was very difficult to do. And over the course of the last 10 years or so, we've evolved to carrying boutique artisan crafted products as well, and so things like really, really rare, interesting vinegars, oils, maple syrups, and just really cool, interesting, unique products. Chefs kind of look to our company to give them creative direction when they're feeling maybe a little bit stumped. So we've always got really interesting, unique stuff in
kind
of our back
pocket.
Oh, you've
got so many testimonials by top chefs in the country on your website. They love you.
They do, and we love them. I mean, it's certainly a passion project of ours. We're all very, very passionate about what we do in this industry and giving great service and providing really awesome, unique, cool products. But we've had a real big focus on local programs as well. We work with a lot of local small farmers, both in New York and in California and in Vancouver and in Seattle. So we really support local farmers and try to be more of a kind of a conduit or liaison between some really quality-minded, excellent growers that are committed to producing food the way it should be, naturally, honestly, with patience and
oh, well, you
and
have a wonderful pool of talent in all those places, Oregon, also Seattle. We interview people all the time from those two places. We just interviewed a farmer, a dairy farmer, cheesemaker from what name of the island?
Yeah, I read that. That family company was around for like 80 years or something, right?
Exactly.
I listened to that one. That guy had a great story.
No, this is a different one. This is a guy who worked in Seattle, and then he went to, I think it's Vashon Island, and he makes cheese.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are tons of them over there. Peter had a question.
Yeah, your target market is mostly chefs or exclusively chefs?
Mostly chefs, 95% chefs right now. I mean, I think there's huge retail potential for what we do. We just haven't had the time or energy or wherewithal to really focus on expanding the retail market of some of the unique stuff that we do. I've talked to a few Whole Foods and some small boutique purveyors, like small boutique kind of specialty food shops, but it hasn't been our main focus. Now, chefs has really been like 95% of our focus.
I think growth's probably been like a word of mouth thing, like Mario Batali tells David Chang and David Chang tells somebody else, and then somebody else tells Sean Brock, and then Sean Brock tells somebody else.
Exactly. At this level, it's such a small, tightly knit community that if you're doing a great job, everyone knows about it. So, I mean, we've only been in New York for 3 years, but the second year that we were here, we had, gosh, I don't know, we had a huge percentage of the fresh white truffle market locked up because we were getting the most amazing fresh white truffles from Italy 2 or 3 times a week. And so
you have a lot of over,
Danielle, and
overseas. I mean, it's not just all local. I mean, you get the...
We do a lot of stuff from Europe and France as well. I mean, we have a huge, huge focus of local products, but you can't get the white Alba truffle anywhere but in Alba. Well, I know Brienne, a few places in Italy, and I think Croatia there are some, but they're not as good, I don't think. But
We found a lot of them in, where was it? It was Abruzzo, or was it the other one? Le Marche, which one?
It was in Le Marche.
Le Marche.
Aquilagna in In La Marca. I think if you do truffles, you must have been there. They're black truffles.
Yeah. The black Perigords or Winters we do quite a bit of as well, but certainly white, fresh white Alba truffles we do the most of in New York, I think.
Tyler, I think that we have a lot of chefs that listen to this program. So before I forget to ask, could you just give us your website in case anybody wants to get in touch with you?
Absolutely, yeah. It's www.mikuniwildharvest.com. Mikuni is spelled M-I-K-U-N-I. Wild harvest, just like it sounds. Mikuni is actually the fusion of two Japanese words. It means beautiful forest. And we came across this name because my partner started in the industry years ago exporting matsutake mushrooms to Japan. So they were kind of one of the first people out there to introduce North American matsutakes into the Japanese market back when it was really, really strong. And they were really considered to be like white gold.
When I wrote to you, I was expecting to get wild edibles and things, and what I got was a product line called Noble. Do you want to explain what that is?
Yeah, Noble is fun. Noble's like my passion project, or one of them, I suppose. I mean, we talk to chefs all the time, and they're passionate people with lots of ideas, and we wanted to have an outlet to work with some of these creative chefs and producers and artists and craftsmen to offer a line of really awesome, cool ingredients. So there was birth to Noble, and we've got five products right now. They're all really interesting and unique. The first one's probably got the most attention. We teamed up with Tuttletown, otherwise known as Hudson Bourbon. They're the first distillery in New York State to make bourbon since the days of Prohibition. So they got a really cool story that they've won tons of awards. We buy their bourbon barrels from them and age this really awesome maple syrup in there, and we get this bourbon barrel-aged maple syrup, Tuttletown bourbon barrel-aged maple syrup. Now, after we age the maple syrup in there and bottle it, we then put a sherry vinegar in those same barrels and age it for a period of time. So it's like a more complex sherry vinegar that's got notes of bourbon and oak and obviously maple to it. And then what we do is we age that for an extended period of time and then get like a refined finishing vinegar. Uh-huh. So a vinegar that was that one, the tonic number 5, the XO vinegar.
Right.
It's got like a really thick viscosity, like almost like a 100-year-old balsamic viscosity.
I drink that right out of those little bottles.
Yeah, it's so good. I mean, you can put that on anything. You put on ice cream, on fruit, on yogurt, get out of town. It's awesome.
Do you happen to know Millicene? I think it was somebody we interviewed from California who imported two lines of vinegars.
Yeah, Jean-Marc Montego Terra, I know it well. That line of vinegars is quite possibly the most refined and delicious line of fruit-forward vinegars.
So you offer those?
We represent Jean-Marc Montego Terra vinegars all across North America.
I have to contact you. They're my most favorite things, the whole one.
Yeah.
And then they had another product line. It was Austrian.
Degenbauer. Yeah.
Fabulous.
Pedro Jimenez vinegar.
Yes.
Are you kidding me? That stuff's like 3% acidity. You could drink it after a meal. It's like an appetite.
I love that stuff.
Actually, the one I liked the best was the cucumber.
I love cucumber.
The cucumber, that was unusual. But a lot of guys are doing different ice creams with some of his vegetable vinegars. Noble is like this collaboration. Like, we're working with a lot of chefs right now on different ideas and collaborative projects. We've got a New York chef that's working with us on a new product line for Noble, or a new product for Noble. It's going to be an all New York based product. We've got New York maple syrup. We've got New York bourbon that we're concentrating and then smoking with New York applewood.
Wow.
And then adding a New York grown Espelette pepper. And kind of the concept behind it's going to be this kind of bacon glaze / libation cocktail mix that's going to be really cool. Likewise, we're working with Sean Brock on some sorghum's molasses that maybe we're going to age in some Pappy Van Winkle bourbon barrels. And Norman Van Aken's actually working on something with us right now with some artisan heirloom cane vinegar and cane syrup, and we're not really sure how we're going to deal with it. We probably
noticed we got some sort of a product line, and it was some sort of super fruit, coffee fruit, and it had sweetening was the cane syrup.
I don't like that. It's way
it was
too
very
sweet.
Sweet.
Now,
be careful.
Now, a couple of the other ones you sent us in the same line. One is all it says on the little tube, sample tube, is Cabernet Franc, and then the other one, it just says Vidal. Now, they're slightly different. They're not vinegars.
Yeah, I didn't know that you got those. Okay.
We got those, too.
That's a curveball. Those are called ice syrup, and there's this winery out in, the Niagara region, and they specifically in this region, they get a lot of freezes and thaws and freezes and thaws. And instead of making an ice wine out of these grapes, they actually don't let it ferment, and they make a syrup out of it. So the only thing that went into that syrup that you tried, the Vidal being the white grape and the Cab Franc, obviously the red, is just the reduced concentrated grape juice that came from those grapes. And the sugar content's so high as a result of it thawing and freezing so many times that you get this really cool, clean, beautifully sweet and sultry sugared-based syrup, grape syrup.
Now, what are people using this for? You said on cheese. Cheese plates.
Yeah, those are great paired with cheese. But, I mean, say you're doing, like, a lovely piece of fish and you're serving a bunch of citrus and you want to do something really light and fruity sauce. I mean, that kind of a streak on a plate is going to cut the richness and add a level of acidity and sweetness to a sauce. So in dessert applications, I mean, it could be used for multiple different things. We are doing a really awesome project right now with Soyoung Scallon from Andante Dairy. I don't know if you know her, but she does the cheese program for, I think, most of TK's restaurants. And she's like one of the foremost cheesemakers in the United States. She's in Petaluma, California.
Okay.
You should look her up. It's Andante Dairy. She's this little Korean woman who's like a savant and
makes
the most remarkable cheese. Yeah, she actually did the whole dairy program for Pierre Garnier's restaurant in Las Vegas. And actually, if you've read the Harold McGee's book on cooking, she did the whole cheese chapter and dairy chapter for him. I think the introduction says for Soyoung and his wife or something. So she's got some remarkable skill, but she's making a goat and cow's cheese for us right now and rubbing the rind with the bourbon barrel aged maple syrup. So
wow.
It's going to be like a noble bourbon barrel cured cheese.
Whose company is Noble?
Noble's ours. It's
okay.
McCooney.
So you started
owns it, and my partners and I started it and just really wanted kind of an expression for chefs to play around with. And so that's why we've teamed up with different chefs like Sean and Norman Van Aken. And
well, you're having a great time. You sound like you're so enthusiastic. And full of energy and having such a great time.
Now, the funny
Thank
part
you.
About it is, to me, the most obvious application of these, I don't know about the vinegars, but certainly of the syrups, is they're making cocktails.
Oh, he's been putting them in cocktails.
They make wicked cocktails.
You're absolutely right. Okay, my go-to autumnal cocktail is the bourbon barrel-aged maple syrup with an unfiltered apple cider with the Hudson bourbon, an egg white, and then finish it, you obviously shake it up, finish it with some nutmeg and this hidden rose apple. We get these apples. It's a Japanese heirloom variety of apple from Oregon, this one farm that grows them. They're called hidden rose apples because they're bright red all the way through. You cut the apple all the way through. They're amazing. So it's like this cool contrast with the red kind of garnishes, and it really comes together. There's actually a lot of bartenders in New York that are working with the Noble products in their cocktails.
Well, you just go a mile a minute. and we know that you are running late starting the interview. We know you have another one coming up very soon, but we thank you for taking time out in Bryant Park, New York. So you're around 6th Avenue and 40th Street as you talk to us.
You're absolutely right.
Tyler, you'd go a mile a minute on your ideas here. Please keep us posted on what you're up to next.
I will, and you know what? I feel bad. I owe you guys some finger limes. I said I was going to get some to you.
I forgot about them, yes.
I just spaced, but I'm going to send you a clamshell of these finger limes, and it's going to yet again, I think, inspire you.
Well, it's out of season, I heard.
No, we have them. We get them from the Santa Monica Farmers Market, and we're getting them every week. It is almost finished. The season's almost finished, but we still have some, and you guys are going to love playing around with those. They're like citrus caviar. They're really cool.
Yeah, we lived in Australia. I never even heard of them.
Well, have a wonderful time in your next adventure. I can't remember where it is, but I'm sure that never a dull moment in your life, Tyler, and you've certainly been a breath of fresh air in ours this afternoon. So thank you so much for taking the time
cool.
to talk to us.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. It was a
Tyler,
pleasure.
You're wonderful.
Say hi to Sean Brock for me.
I will. I mean, you'd be a lot of fun to just hang around with.
Hey, anytime. You're in New York or Vancouver. Those are my two stomping grounds. I'd love to take you out for food and drinks.
Great.
Or maybe a foraging session for some wild ramps or morels.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I forage in my backyard, believe it or not. I mean, I have good stuff in my backyard.
Cool. Well, keep it up, and thanks so much for having me on your show.
Stay with us, or we'll be back on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. In our final segment for today's program, we have a fascinating story of a man who had a career that, of a normal American kind and decided to give
he
it all up.
He was a restaurateur, and he jumped to the other side. He was a farmer.
He became a farmer, and right. I guess he makes cheese.
He makes cheese.
In a big island in Puget Sound, and it's a really fascinating story. But it's a life story, and a memoir and all of that stuff, and something I think you'll enjoy if you ever thought about the idea of going back to the land.
On the menu, listeners, you should be very grateful. The guest we're talking to today has not been washed away by a tsunami, since we're recording with him on a day when there was a wave that started off all the way with an earthquake in Japan. And you're sheltered in Puget Sound on your little island, to Kurt Timmermeister. But what's it like there today?
It's still rather blustery here. We're well protected from the ocean, certainly. We're in a very protected Puget Sound. But it's definitely, we're near the ocean for sure. Still fall here.
No, but you're not going to have a tidal wave that's going to wash over part of your farm.
I highly doubt it. I'm on the very top of the island, well off of the water.
Now, you're in an unusual location, situated on quite a large island in Puget Sound that's sort of almost as the crow flies between Seattle and Tacoma, Washington.
Absolutely. We're right in the middle, very close to the cities, and yet it's a rather rural island that it really hasn't been greatly developed.
And you're on a rural island for a reason, because you're pursuing a very rural pursuit of being a farmer, but you didn't start out doing that, did you?
Absolutely not. I had absolutely no interest in it and no experience in it. I lived in a city in Seattle in a neighborhood, and then started opening restaurants, and that's what I did for most of my early adult life.
Okay, so you got into food from the using it in a restaurant end.
Absolutely.
I think we ought to mention that there's a documentation of this in a book that Kurt just wrote called Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land.
Well, if you let me start the interviews, I always get them wrong. But it's a fascinating story, even if you don't have time to read the book. So what happened then? You had sort of an epiphany that said, I don't want to do this anymore?
Yeah, I started serving a lot of food. The restaurant was rather large at the end. We served a lot of food, lots of people, and I started to look at the food coming in the back door differently and seeing that I really wasn't happy with the quality of the food that I was getting. And I couldn't figure out how to get a much better quality of food. And the way I realized was if I grew it myself, if I started planting vegetables and so on and apples and other orchard trees, that I could get some good food. And that's how it started, little by little by little, starting many years ago, nearly 20 years ago now, when I very first got the land.
So you predated this current rush of urbanites to sort of roll into farming.
This wave of it, I may have predated it a bit, but I would look back to Scott Nearing in the 30s, leaving New York City and going up to Vermont and starting his own farm. At that point, I think we've been doing this for many, many years. Or, you know, Betty McDonald in the 40s starting, you know, an egg farm and writing the Egg and I and so on. I think we've been doing this for many, many, you know, decades. But I certainly am a little ahead of the curve of this current kind of back to the land movement.
But you had quite an adventure in the process of doing that, right? And that leads us to one of the first things you said you wanted to talk about, which is the challenge of surviving as a small farmer. I mean, you started out from being a zero farmer, so it must have been even more difficult for you.
You know, I must say that I've had a fairly charmed life, and that I had a profitable business in the early part of my career, so that I could be a farmer in the kind of post 40-year-old profession. But it is important to me to note that it is challenging to be profitable as a small farm financially, and that is one of the things I wanted people to understand and to find in this book.
So do you explain how you can deal with that challenge in the book?
I discuss it. I'm not sure that I have an answer for it. I don't know that anyone has kind of cracked this this challenge of trying to find a way to make small farms profitable. I found a way to make mine profitable, which is that I produce one item primarily, which is a fresh cow's milk cheese called Dinah's cheese, that I can price accordingly, that I can price to make the farm profitable.
Okay, and it's a good enough product that you're able to do that.
Yes, that makes it,
and there's not a lot of competition for it. That's the great part about this product I make. And it's
what is a Dynas cheese?
It's called Dynas cheese. It's like a Camembert cheese. Like it's about 8 ounces,
uh-huh.
And it's I sell it all over Seattle, and I can set the price at what I need it to be, which is different than if I was selling carrots, for example.
I got you. Yes. So you're marking to the market, and as long as the market will sustain your price, you're going to be okay.
Yes, or at least I hope so. I mean, it's so far so good. How's that?
That's pretty good. I mean, I would suppose over time it sort of probably gets easier.
It's still a great challenge on a day to day basis without question, but certainly better than in the early days when I thought I could sell vegetables and pay the mortgage and
okay,
pay
so,
the health insurance. And so
on. So you tried that. Starting out, you tried that.
I started with vegetables, which is what most people start with, and sold vegetables at the farmers markets and so on. And realized very quickly that it was going to be a huge challenge to make any sort of profit of this volume I needed to pay the bills that it took to run a farm.
Now, did you grow up as a farmer or did you grow up as a city boy?
I grew up as a city boy. Absolutely.
Okay, so it must have been really quite different to move out to Vashon Island.
Yeah, certainly. Although it's been a most challenging, most enjoyable. Challenge for sure. I really love it here. It's a beautiful community. It's near the city, yet it's not in any way a city. It's a great challenge, even if it is difficult.
Some of my greatest friends are actually in the Seattle area, all over the place, doing John Rowley doing his oysters, Taylor
yep.
Farm, all the foragers we've encountered who were brave in the face of wild mushrooms, and it's a wonderful food community.
It's a beautiful, beautiful place, and it has a great tell in this area who really want high-quality food. They're willing to pay for it, and they're very educated, and they definitely want it. I think other parts of the country may be less so, but certainly Seattle has that. I was just in San Francisco the last few days. That community, even more so than Seattle, is incredibly committed to local foods and very high quality.
You mentioned that there was another theme that you wanted to talk about that underlies the science of farming and the emotion of farming in the
right.
way that you do it. So let's talk a little bit about respect for the livestock.
Growing up in a city, I had no contact with cows, with sheep, with pigs, with chickens whatsoever, except to go to the grocery store like everyone else and buy, a steak or some chicken breasts or something for dinner. And for my entire life, that was perfectly fine. And for most people, it is. Now that I've raised chickens, raised cows and pigs, raised them for a year or 2 years in case like a cow, a steer, and then to slaughter it, I've really had a sea change of what that means and what that's like. And it's now incredibly important to me that people respect meat and they very much realize where the meat that they have for dinner comes from.
Well, this is a pretty strong statement by a whole group of people in this country now. How does your book add to this discussion? I mean, we have people writing about this constantly now. Some of the people who provided testimony, actually, for your
book. I give a very nuts and bolts of how we slaughter animals on this farm. Mostly pigs is what I talk about, of really, like, the nuts and bolts of that. That day when people come out to the farm to help me, how we slaughter them, how they're butchered, how they're gutted, and so on, and really what it means to me on an emotional level and on a physical level of how it happens, and that's how I want to talk about it. I want people to very much get connected to their meat on that level. I don't really expect everyone. I obviously don't expect everyone to slaughter their own meat for dinner.
These butcher classes at $125 a shot, they're flying out the door. I mean, there's so many people spending whole days learning.
It's huge. It's certainly in this part of the country, and I assume it's in a lot of parts of the country.
Oh, yeah.
Teaching people how to butcher meat and so on. I think it's necessary. I think it's long overdue, I would say. And I relish it, that people really have this great love of it now, and we're revisiting it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd certainly love to get rid of all the big factory farming, especially with the animals and the feedlots.
I, I think we'll change it. I think, you know, Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, certainly started that going, started us to look at those large factory farms differently, and the large slaughterhouses. And I think that there's hope now. I don't think I would have said that 20 years ago, but I think, you know, we're really going to start seeing smaller slaughterhouses or more localized ones or something. I think a little change in the USDA could kind of push that along a little faster if they changed the laws, made them a little bit more lenient for smaller slaughterhouses or individual people who slaughter animals on their farms and sell them. I think that would make a huge change.
Well, this is a fascinating read. This is an interesting story. City boy goes country, gets to love it, and has a message for everybody. So, Anne, as a final thought?
Yeah, I outlined some of the difficulties you encounter, things that you didn't expect. I just wanted your thoughts on what was the most surprising drawback to farming you encountered?
I think the great difference that I try to explain to people is it continues 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. When you hear it, people kind of nod and understand it, but when you realize that you really have to really make a great effort to leave, to get a day off or any time off. I live at the office, essentially. Really hard to take a day off. And it's great, but when it's difficult, you still want to get off once in a while, and that's hard.
Yeah, my great-uncle was a dairy farmer, and I don't think he had a day off in his whole life.
No, I'm trying to change that. I like to work very hard, but I still need to get away once in a while. I think it's much healthier, and getting a day off is much easier if you work in an office in the city, no question. As much as I love my farm, it's constant, and it can be exhausting. And I think that's the thing that I'm experiencing the most. I didn't foresee it quite as well as I had wished.
Well, how about a website for people who are interested in contacting you or getting the book or buying your cheese?
Absolutely. My website is Kurtwood Farms, with an S on the end, KURTWOODFARMS.com. I sell cheese all over Seattle in the stores. Occasionally we ship it as well. And it's super tasty, and the book is on that website, and lots of photos of the farm, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Okay, so it's Kurt Timmermeister, Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land. Thank you, Kurt.
Oh, thank you.
Well, there you have it. Now you know much more than you did before about where your food comes from and why it's important where it comes from. So we're glad to be able to bring you this program, and we'll be back same time, same place with a different theme, but on the menu once again next week. So for now,
bye-bye.